In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Would it surprise you if I said that so many of the talking heads and some of the so-called smartest people did not understand the big, beautiful bill, including what could and could not be in it and what was actually in it, and what it really represented? It's a bit like what happened with Trump's reciprocal tariffs. The entire left, and even some on the right, went ballistic. And wasn't that a change? Suddenly, people on the economic left were all concerned about free markets. But none of the shriekers appeared to know a thing about Trump's strategic approach to deal-making. Use leverage to accomplish long-term success. And then, just a couple of weeks ago, some economists started to admit they were wrong about Trump's tariffs. They are already bringing in a lot of money, that we're not entering a recession because of them, and that our economy is expanding and will expand further because of them. And what have we seen the last few weeks? Similar shrieking about the big beautiful bill by Democrats and so-called smart people, including Elon Musk, who threw an absolute temper tantrum. There is so much to talk about today. Well, let's dive right in. Jonathan Williams is the president and chief economist over at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He's also the co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report on the economic competitiveness among the states and their economic outlook. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks again for having me, my friend. And it's the land of make-believe, and greetings from the land of make-believe here in D.C. There still is a little bit of that, but it's a little bit less so after the last couple of weeks here. I think it's been a good couple of weeks for taxpayers, and certainly with the big, beautiful bill that you just referenced in the opening.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the last time we talked was right before the big, beautiful bill was passed out of the House and headed over to the Senate. It did not have nearly enough tax cuts, spending cuts, as you or I would have liked. So we knew we would have to have you back on soon. Plus, we had wanted to have you on to talk about the latest edition of Rich States, Poor States to hear how Oregon was doing. But in the time since we last talked, there were some recent revelations and developments that will almost certainly make things worse for Oregon's outlook, including one that I'm not sure that you knew about because I only recently learned about it myself. But let's start with the big, beautiful bill there. Not to sound too much like Nancy Pelosi, but now that the one big, beautiful bill has passed and signed into law, we know what's in it. And just to give kind of a quick summary here, the bill emphasizes pro-growth reforms and middle-class relief while also restructuring entitlement programs. It prioritized border security funding, thus ensuring that more jobs will be available for American citizens, not people here illegally. And we'll come back to that in a later segment. It makes permanent the 2017 Trump tax cuts, preventing a huge tax increase, and introduces new provisions to boost take-home pay, support seniors, support middle and low-income earners through such things as no tax on tips and overtime, and incentivizes domestic manufacturing. So what is Alex's assessment of the Big Beautiful Bill? What do you guys see as the big wins in that? Any favorites?
Well, there's a lot to say here. I mean, in terms of something this large is going to have something in it for everyone that people like, and it's going to probably have some things in it that people don't like. But I think the most important thing to remember here, Mark, is this is a huge deal for the economy. Mm-hmm. And if it would have not passed, and we would be facing, you know, the largest tax increase in American history by default at mm-hmm. the end of the year if Congress would have done nothing. As we've talked about many times, the Trump tax relief from 2017, all of that for individuals would have gone away, and a good deal of it for small businesses as well. And so I think, you know, one of the first things that I think about to summarize what could be a very long discussion and the intricacies of what was there and the good, bad, there's really not a lot of ugly there. It's a very good bill in general, I think. But the important thing is we as a country, our American economy, and we all as taxpayers dodged a major bullet in terms of not allowing those tax cuts to expire. I think, in my opinion, that would have almost guaranteed an economic downturn in the country, and certainly would have guaranteed a personal economic downturn for millions of hardworking taxpayers. So that's point one. There's a lot of other things non-tax related as well. But one other element of the tax changes, so much of the pro-growth tax relief that was there in the final passage that came from the Senate, remember the House had the choice more or less, is if they wanted to get this on the desk of President Trump by the 4th of July, per the president's desire, they needed to either take the Senate version straight up, which is what they ended up doing, or they would need to amend and go to some sort of a conference committee, and that would take all summer to get that done. And so I think in a lot of ways, they wisely decided to take the Senate version. And what that did was the Senate version versus the House, the Senate version was permanent on many of these pro-growth tax cuts. So that is a huge victory that doesn't get talked about nearly enough in the mainstream media, Mark, is that for many, many years, going back to the Bush tax cuts, because of these arcane rules in the United States Senate, we have these things on phase-outs of most major legislation on taxes. And so more or less, the American taxpayer and the American economy has been operating under temporary tax codes now for the last 20 plus years. That comes to an end with the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill because of the permanent nature of the rate reduction of the small business expensing and treatment for Main Street businesses across the country, among many other favorable pro-growth provisions. And that's something I think we can all celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's my understanding that the average family stands to gain about $13,300 in additional take-home pay, while workers could see wage increases of more than $11,600. So that's pretty impressive there. But one of the things that was talked a lot about leading into it, and the Democrats, as usual, were really misleading people. A new tax deduction ensures that some seniors will pay no taxes at all on Social Security benefits. Seniors earning up to $75,000 as individuals or $150,000 as couples will receive a $6,000 or $12,000 for couples deduction. I think that's pretty impressive. The White House is saying that up to 90% of seniors on Social Security will pay no taxes at all.
No, I think that's an important element that also didn't get enough attention. And I know there's some, you know, and good debates around, you know, tax policy wonks in D.C. about Social Security being taxable or not. I think it's just an extra layer of tax. I mean, people have clearly already paid taxes on that income a couple of times. And Social Security, I think, makes a lot of sense to avoid taxing. Another major benefit for seniors, though, that was included was the permanent expansion of the deductions and the exemption, I should say, for the death tax. Mm-hmm. This is something that has been a very stubborn tax to try to get rid of. It raises next to zero for federal coffers, but it's a huge problem for family businesses and family farms, and it breaks up those things upon the death of a loved one. Not if you didn't have it already enough to worry about if you lose one of your loved ones, but have to deal with the tax man coming in to get their take, I think is morally reprehensible and financially not a good move for the United States. And so that is a great provision to permanently extend those death tax relief pieces from the Trump tax cuts the last time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a ton more to talk about this because there are so many big wins on this. Let's go and take a break. Coming up, who should you believe? And some very smart people who are very wrong. Maybe people should stop listening to them, but keep listening here. More with Jonathan Williams, President and Chief Economist of American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking today with Jonathan Williams, the President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, and what we've been learning about the Big Beautiful Bill now that it's been signed. And Jonathan, in that last segment, we talked about some big wins for the American people in the Big Beautiful Bill that is cutting taxes, will put more money in more people's pockets, cutting spending, and gearing up the economy to start roaring again. This is a tremendous change from where we might have been. And given what we just talked about, it's almost shocking to think about this, but I'd like you to imagine for just a moment the nightmare we'd be having right now if Kamala Harris had won and the kind of bill we would have gotten out of that administration.
Yeah, no doubt. And imagine if Kamala Harris would have won, what would the United States Senate look like? I mean, almost assuredly, it would be a Democrat-run U.S. Senate and members of the House. So you'd have Speaker Jeffries or Speaker Pelosi again. So heaven forbid, you know, that scenario, that then they would be talking about using the same 51-vote threshold of reconciliation that was used to pass the BBB just recently here to enact some sort of a new big government Green New Deal fantastic proposal from a liberal perspective that they would be pushing down all of our throats, right? Like we saw during the Biden administration from the far left. So you're right. It's a huge change in Washington. And, you know, kudos to Speaker Mike Johnson, especially, I think, for keeping that House together. And, you know, Leader Thune deserves a lot of credit in the Senate as well. But, you know, with a 3 or 4 vote margin on a given day in the U.S. House out of, you know, over 400 members there, that is yeoman's work. I was on a conversation with him and some of our conservative allies yesterday, and what I heard was he was receiving something like 1,000 texts per hour during that BBB discussion from people all across the country, and of course the members of his Republican conference and probably Democrat members looking to find different provisions to talk about. So, I mean, he's an ALEC alum, as we've talked about before, and he brings a lot of common sense from the state of Louisiana and states that have to balance their budget every year and kind of go through what most Americans would think Washington should do more of. And so thank you to Johnson, Speaker Johnson, for his leadership in this, for sure. Wouldn't have happened without that.
Yeah, I have to say that I was impressed with him as he was steering that the whole big, beautiful bill through and bringing people back on board. And we're going to come back around to that just a little bit here. But in the lead up to the big, beautiful bill passing, there was a lot of debate, especially in terms of the scoring of the bill. And as usual, there are competing scorings of the bill, meaning what it will cost and what it will do and so forth. The Congressional Budget Office says that it was going to add $3 trillion of new debt over 10 years. And that's the figure that all of the everybody that was opposed to this, like Elon Musk, that's the figure they latched onto. But Trump's Office of Economic Advisors said it will lower the debt by $4 trillion. I mean, that's not a rounding error. That's a $7 trillion difference. I mean, of course, these are projections based on numbers and math. And so one might easily and logically assume that two people doing the math would arrive at roughly the same answers. As an economist yourself, can you explain to our audience why there were such two wildly different forecasts?
Well, that is the multi-trillion-dollar question, right, Mark? Yeah, I was at a conversation recently with another person who really deserves a lot of kudos to get this for getting this done, and that's Ways and Means Committee Chair Jason Smith from Missouri, formerly our ALEC chair in Missouri when he served in the state legislature, a great friend of ours. He was explaining this to me the other day, and, you know, it's essentially, I think the CBO is operating under some of the most pessimistic assumptions that you could think of, you know, that they're assuming that the United States economy is going to grow at, I think, something like 1.8% over a long period of time, which would defy all historical periods of time in the past of the United States, right? And so if you take a very pessimistic about the future of the United States, of the economy and the growth of GDP, well, then, you know, that's how you get these pessimistic forecasts in many cases. But they also use some very strange ways of measuring specific provisions in the tax bill. You know, for instance, the death tax provision they thought was going to be a massive money loser for the government. And, you know, the interesting thing about the CBO and Joint Committee of Taxation is they were proven to be quite wrong on their projections the last time around, which makes me feel like they probably, while the goalpost may be quite the other side of this on the President's Council of Economic Advisors estimate, and their GDP estimate was, you know, quite a bit higher. Truth may be somewhere in the middle, usually, but I will say the CBO and the Joint Committee of Taxation do not have a good track record. They vastly underestimated the economic growth coming out of the Trump tax cuts in 2017. They expected massive deficits. And of course, what we saw in the years after was we hit record levels of federal tax collections after cutting rates dramatically. We saw the Laffer curve play out in economics. And so I'm with Chairman Smith. I think that the CBO and the Joint Committee of Taxation were far too pessimistic the last time around, and I think they'll be proven to be far too pessimistic this time around as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how reliable they are, but there you go, you beat me to it. So the week after the big, beautiful bill passed, we had an incredible jobs report for June. The news in that was especially encouraging for American-born workers. The headlines were is that American-born workers gained 2 million jobs since January. And what a difference. Under Biden, there were months and months and months, it seems, where all of the job gains were entirely for non-citizens while American citizens were losing jobs. Specifically, what that report showed for June is that the number of foreign-born workers' jobs for them declined by 348,000 from May and June. And since January 2025, it had dropped by a total of 543,000. And by contrast, jobs for U.S.-born workers increased by 830,000 from May to June and are up 2 million since the start of the second Trump administration. I mean, that's phenomenal. More than a 2.5 million job swing.
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing about the jobs number from my perspective is, you know, you had something that was probably holding back the jobs market, which was this uncertainty about what was going to happen with taxes. And, mm-hmm. and like I said in the last segment, Americans and businesses have been operating with this uncertainty, whether it's, you know, 7 years out or whether it's a year out in the case of, or 6 months out in the case of this year, of the potential expiration of those Trump tax cuts from 2017. And that's a thing that keeps capital on the sidelines. And businesses aren't going to make investments unless they have a little bit more certainty than the tax code completely going away if Congress does nothing. And so I think when you add in the certainty element of this and making the Trump tax cuts now permanent, and you add in things like the deductions for small businesses, the 100% bonus depreciation, the immediate expensing of research and development costs, you know, these are overlooked but very powerful provisions for job creators across the United States. And, you know, that's something that I think we see new jobs numbers. Those jobs numbers surprised a lot of the consensus estimates, right, coming into the last round. And I think we're going to see more of that going forward now that we have certainty in the tax code and we have some of these very important pro-growth provisions that were included in the final passage.
Yeah. Okay, it is time for a break. Not everybody was happy with that big, beautiful bill. In fact, some people were quite disgruntled and flipped out, like Elon Musk, who now wants to go form his own party. What would it surprise you that they didn't actually understand or read the bill? We'll talk about some things that went unnoticed up next. And welcome back. We're talking about the big, beautiful bill that just was signed into law. Back on July 4th, we're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist over at American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, I wanted to talk about some things that went unnoticed with the whole big, beautiful bill. And one of the things that you brought up during the break was the SALT deduction. So go ahead and talk to us about that.
Well, it's a big effort. You know, this starts from the very beginning. So when we started the 2017 discussions, you know, I was invited by then Chairman Kevin Brady of House Ways and Means Committee to submit testimony for that very first hearing of what became the TCJA there and the Trump tax cuts. And so we've been following this from the very start. And one of the, I think, most key things of this that from a policy perspective that we hear from our legislators, and this was something going all the way back to the Reagan era of the 80s, Ronald Reagan said, you know, unfinished business of my major tax reforms that were transformational for the United States, right? And some of the biggest tax cuts at the time in American history that put America on a 20-year trajectory of economic growth and domination, really, of worldwide economy and growth. And what we saw then, you know, his unfinished business, he said, was he couldn't get rid of the sacred cow of the tax code, and that was the so-called state and local deduction. That is the fact that wealthy individuals from blue states with high spending and high taxing love to be able to deduct those things and make the rest of America pay for those high tax burdens in high tax states. And there's nothing that we have against wealthy individuals, and there's nothing we have. In fact, we spend our every day thinking about how we can fight against big and bad tax policy across the country. We just think those decisions should happen in places like Salem and Springfield and Albany and Sacramento, and not Washington, D.C., and asking the low-tax states that, by the way, we're seeing this tax cut revolution happen in at least 25 or 30 states in the last several years. Those states are looking at making themselves more efficient and cutting taxes. They should not be picking up the tab from the high-tax states. And so we at ALEC had a state legislator letter that had more than 630 state legislators from 48 states signed it. A good number from Oregon signed it as well, saying we need to make these tax cuts permanent, but we also should not go back to the previous law, which was a unlimited ability to deduct these high tax burdens at the state level off your federal return. And so what we got, of course, is part of the compromise. The House had a difficult time with this, so they have a few from New York in the Republican caucus that thought that this was just a political survival mode for them, and when you have a margin as low as they do right now in the United States House, I get the numbers on it. But in the Senate version, which was, of course, the final BBB passage, what the compromise was is, you know, permanently starting in 2030, that cap is going to go back down to the 10,000 limit, which was the Trump tax cuts originally, and that's going to be the law going forward. So it was a major victory, I think, for taxpayers across the country. And by the way, Mark, it's a big pay for in terms of keeping the rates down in other areas such as small businesses and taxes for individuals instead of just giving it away to the high tax states and wealthy taxpayers in those states.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that we have talked about in the past is when it comes to things like the SALT deductions, the problem with that is that it really removes the pain of bad decisions. So these high tax states, they basically get a waiver on that on their tax returns. And so people aren't feeling that. And maybe they would vote differently if they didn't, in fact, feel the pain of those bad decisions. Back when Obama was president, but had a Republican-controlled House and Senate, he famously said, "I've got a pen and I've got a phone and I can use that pen to sign executive orders." Yeah, well, so does the next president. Executive orders are only as good as the current administration. And while people like Elon complained about the bill, here's something largely overlooked. It codified some of Trump's executive orders, 28 of them. They are no longer just executive orders. They are now officially law. And you can see the whole list of them on iSpyRadio.com. Today's show is 15-28. But here's just some highlights here. Securing our borders. There's five of those, six in total to do with border security and immigration. Implementing the president's DOGE cost efficiency initiative. Reducing the federal bureaucracy, and of course, that's a big thing now with the Supreme Court saying, yes, of course, Trump can fire the people that he needs to. There are two of them dealing with waste, stopping waste, fraud, and abuse. There are four of them dealing with unleashing American energy, two natural resource-related ones, immediate measures to increase American mineral production and timber production. There are two dealing with education, when improving education outcomes by empowering parents, states and communities, and then also reforming accreditation to strengthen higher education. And there's several others here as well. So so much focus was on the spending or what wasn't being spent and whether or not we're reducing the deficits and stuff. And that's great. We should be focused on that. But here are a lot of things that people like Musk said they wanted in there, and there it was, and they just didn't either bother to read it or just simply didn't know.
Well, those are great points and often overlooked. I was at the White House earlier this week meeting with the Domestic Policy Council and some of the folks there with some of our state legislators who were in town from an ALEC perspective. And it was a great meeting, but they talked about many of these policy provisions that were codified there by the Big Beautiful Bill. And you're right about executive orders. They're important, but they're only as good as long as the current occupant of 1600 is in office. And so putting them in law is an important step. And these are all big priorities that the president of the United States campaigned on, talked about, and he heard from Americans that said these are things that are important. And so including them in this big, beautiful bill, I think, is incredible. And this is one of the biggest moves towards federal school choice and empowering parents ever in the history of the United States. And that's a huge area. And one other area of it that doesn't get enough attention there on education is the expansion of the 529 savings plans. That is a huge area for many families, whether it's we're looking at private K-12 education or higher education, to use that in flexible savings opportunities. You also had the health savings account expansion and the ability of more Americans to use those dollars for plans and to mix them with bronze and catastrophic level plans that had not been allowed previously. And so lots more flexibility on the healthcare section, on education, on energy development, on border security. And that's just a few. I mean, I know we probably want to separately talk about the changes to Medicaid as well, because that was a huge area of debate here in Washington. It got a lot of criticism from some of the usual corners of Washington, D.C., that never want to see any major changes. But I think, you know, if we're going to get serious about the debt, and I think this administration does want to get serious and is serious, we saw some really important fiscally conservative policies as part of this big, beautiful bill. But to have the courage to take on Medicaid that many other administrations have shied away from even talking about, that showed real courage.
Yeah, it did. And in addition to those executive orders being codified, Trump, after the bill was passed, used his rescission power to wipe out a bunch of things that the House Republicans had wanted to leave out of the final bill, such as the green energy tax credits, and those are now gone. So, all right, let's go and take a break there. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams talking about the big, beautiful bill, including a major shifting of the ground. Did you feel it? Because it could be a major change in the way Washington is thinking. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist over at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out more about them and the great work they do, such as advising your state legislators on how to improve your state's economy. You can find them over at ALEC, that's ALEC.org. And you should certainly encourage your legislators, county, and city officials to all join ALEC, because who doesn't like a great economy? And Jonathan, after that bill passed, I said on social media that the big, beautiful bill is not the end, it's the beginning. And lo and behold, a couple days later, after I said that, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, said the same thing. He said the big, beautiful bill is just the first step of a three-tier strategy, and he expects a second reconciliation bill by fall and a third one by spring. He said you'll see more of us advancing these common sense principles to deliver the America First agenda. And the reason I said what I did on social media is that, to me, the really big takeaway from all of this is the big, beautiful bill represents a monumental shift in mindset when it comes to spending and the size of government in Washington, D.C., of all places. We see that sometimes on the state levels, but here it is at the federal level. And for once, we have a gigantic bill that wasn't about passing gigantic spending and giant tax increases and giant regulations and gigantic government overreach. Instead, it was about gigantic cuts, giving a gigantic boost to the economy, which will generate even more revenue for the government, not less, because of the tax cuts. For the simple reason that when more people are making more money, it means more money for the government. And in the past, we've had some bills that have kind of chipped away at some spending, but nothing that I can remember large scale like this. In 2017, Trump had his big tax cuts passed, and those have thankfully been now codified and made permanent. But I honestly can't recall the last time we had a bill to cut spending this much, spending and cutting back on the size and scope of the federal government. I guess maybe the Newt Gingrich era back in the 1990s. What are your thoughts? Is the big, beautiful bill a new era? Because I'm hearing more people saying, hey, we need to cut even more.
Well, I think yes and yes. It's a new era. It was a transformational change piece of legislation on so many different policy fronts, and taxes being first and foremost, but so many other areas. And also, we need to continue to do more on spending reductions, right? Because the national debt has been an issue that both parties have struggled with mightily over decades. And it's something that we all need to come together and find solutions for. And, you know, you look at the Office of Management and Budget numbers, this big, beautiful bill reduces the deficit by, you know, something like $1.4 trillion. So it is a major down payment on that effort, and more needs to be done. And I think everyone here agrees, from Speaker Johnson to Leader Thune to the White House, that more does need to be done. But one other element of this that we just touched on briefly that is, I think, going to be so key for states and for the federal government going forward is addressing Medicaid properly and addressing program and integrity. Because, you know, talking about a common sense agenda like Speaker Johnson did, that you referred to there, is exactly the right way to think about this, because many Americans are just shocked and horrified to hear that so much of the spending growth has gone, because of Obamacare, to able-bodied working age men with no children, and being diverted away from people that have real disabilities and people that have to take care of dependent children and dependent adults in their homes and aren't able to go out into the workforce. And so this was a common sense reform to bring back work requirements. And so I'm glad you mentioned Speaker Gingrich, because, I mean, this was the discussion we had in the 1990s with the Contract with America and welfare to work, and to bring more people into that scenario where they can have earned success and get off of welfare and into the workforce, you know, filling these jobs, as we talked about. There's going to be many more job openings across the United States for Americans. That's a very positive thing. And now we need to make sure that people are empowered to go out and do that. You know, the first part of that is when you have that ability is to stop subsidizing people to stay home and make sure that the able-bodied do get into the workforce. And when they do get into the workforce, make sure you don't overtax them and give them that disincentive to go into the workforce. And so those are two key elements of this. And I'm really proud of everyone for having the courage to look out for the truly needy and to bring Medicaid program integrity. And, you know, it's shameful the kind of protests that we saw here in Washington from some of the pro-disability lobby out there that, you know, these are the professional lobbyists for the disability sector and those that are disabled. And it's shameful, right? Because they should be the ones cheering on this kind of reform to enhance program integrity for Medicaid for the truly disabled. And yet they were out there talking about how this was a cruel reform that would somehow rob Medicaid.
Yes.
So sometimes in D.C., once again, it is the land to make believe after all.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of crazy because you're talking Medicaid, and of course, there were some, they were finding a whole bunch of fraud, waste, and abuse over in Social Security as well. And over in Dallas, a neighboring town here, they have routinely a little mini protest there. It's a small crowd, usually about maybe 30 people, and almost all of them are seniors. And of course, they're there because they've been duped by Democrats on TV telling them that Trump is going to take away their Social Security. And yet, here they are saving money in Social Security by cutting out that fraud, waste, and abuse. I suppose all of those Democrats, because none of them, you know, none of the senators or the in the House voted for the bill. I hope that on the tax forms for next year, they will have a little checkbox that you don't want the Trump tax cuts on Social Security, you know, on principle. Do you know if they're going to do that?
Well, you know, as it turns out, the Treasury Department has a little section that accepts voluntary payments of those that think they're not taxed enough in the United States. And as it turns out, despite all of the rhetoric that we hear on MSNBC and the liberal news outlets, not many people end up taking that opportunity to cut that personal check to the United States. They just want the rest of hardworking Americans to pay it more into the Treasury. So I guess they get their favorite spending program. Yeah. So I think, yeah, we do need to call that hypocrisy out.
Absolutely. All right. Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we'll start talking about rich states, poor states with Jonathan Williams. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist over at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And we've been talking about the big, beautiful bill, but now we want to start switching into rich states, poor states, of which he is one of the co-authors. So you can find out more about that by heading to richstatespoorstates.org. And so we want to talk to you about Oregon. But before we get there, Alex is, of course, more state-focused than federal-focused. But, of course, federal rules and taxes impact states. So now that the federal government has cut taxes and has started down the path of cutting spending and reducing government, I guess the question is, what will the states do in response? Do you expect some will say, and I'm looking at those blue states, some will try to say, aha, people are paying less in federal taxes, so we should start charging more at the state level. Or will other states say, if you thought those spending cuts and tax cuts were impressive, wait until you see what we do?
Yeah, I think you're going to see some of the both of those approaches. And the only problem for the blue states that would want to follow that approach of raising taxes and trying to make up for otherwise good tax cuts happening at the federal level is this thing called competition. And as long as we have the 50 laboratories of democracy and people are free to move between states and businesses are free to relocate, as we see every single year, blue states and big government states can only get away with so much. And we know that California's hit that limit despite its beautiful beaches and amazing weather and all the other things that it has. Silicon Valley and all those elements of California. California continues to hemorrhage individuals and businesses voting with their feet and going to other states for more economic opportunity. I mean, it's something we pointed out for the last 18 years now in the Rich States, Poor States report. And so, yeah, the blue states might see that and they may look for ways to raise more revenue, but they're going to continue to hasten their own decline and do it at their own peril. The red states and many of the states are the fiscally, you know, minded states out there are going to continue, I think, with this tax cut revolution that we're seeing play out before our very eyes coming out of the pandemic. And Mark, one of the very interesting things we've seen is not only just cutting tax rates, but we've now had 8 states coming out of the pandemic that have become flat tax states that got away from the penalizing success mantra of the progressive tax structures that have gone to a single rate flat tax. And we actually had 2 states this year, Mississippi and Oklahoma, both vote to begin to phase out their personal income tax altogether. And it's been a long time since we've seen a state completely eliminate its income tax. You have to go back about 4 decades when Alaska did, but now we've got several states within striking distance. So I think this divide between the states that are cutting taxes and the states that are raising taxes, this balkanization effect really that we're seeing on tax policy, is going to probably continue to grow. And you know, at the end of the day, may the best state win. And we're seeing that every single year with the states that are cutting taxes.
Well, you had mentioned this notion of this mantra of tax the wealthy. That's such a flawed thinking, because what they're really doing is they're punishing the people who are most able to move and take their companies with them. So I at some point, I hope that connects with Democrats, because they seem to be the one most willing to tax the rich. There was a trade deal that I think bears right into this, both the federal level and how some of the decisions at the federal level impact states. There was a trade deal that kind of flew under the radar. Back on July 2nd, Trump announced a trade deal with Vietnam, of all places, and it was the first ever. It includes a 20% tariff on Vietnam's goods, and they added a 40% tariff on a process called transshipping. And this is where goods that originate in another country for final shipping into the U.S. It's a means for countries like China to circumvent trade barriers. In fact, I just had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a farmer's wife about this, and she is very passionate. She's very anti-China. I think she grew up there. China has used transshipping to manipulate hazelnut markets, which, of course, is very big here in Oregon, especially in the Willamette Valley. What she said China is doing is they buy from Turkey at a low cost, ship them to Vietnam before shipping them onto the United States to undercut hazelnut market here, and it drives down the cost. The price dropped so low a couple of years ago that farmers she personally knew could not stay in business any longer and lost their farms because of it. This is why these tariffs, which so many people freaked out about, are so important.
Well, it's a good point of, you see a lot of manipulation there and hiding the ball from China and other competitors out there, and going through third-party nations, like you mentioned there with the Vietnamese example. You know, another one that's very interesting on the trade front, Mark, that I just learned about this week was the discussions with our friends in the UK and some of the renegotiation of trade deals where, up until recently, and the negotiations happened, the UK, I think, goes back, 20 or 30 years, had not been buying American beef and not allowing beef exports from the United States into the UK, or even places like Australia weren't accepting it. And so the UK was getting all of their steaks and beef from other countries, but not the United States. And it was because of an example of something that had happened with a bad actor like, 30 or 40 years ago. And because President Trump came to the table to say, like, hey, what's the deal going on here and why can't we fix this? He got it fixed, as I understand, as we heard from the Commerce Department just the other day about that discussion. So these are the kind of things that have real world examples. Yes. Like you mentioned, one in Oregon, anybody that's a steak lover in the UK is going to have some great American beef,
there,
and it's great for farmers and ranchers here in the US.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's we only got about a minute and a half here in this segment, but real quick, Oregon was ranked 43rd this year. That's a drop of one. I look back though, and in 2008 we had our best year with you. Our very first year was 35th. We went back 4 notches in to 39th in the second year, and then we have never since gotten below 41. So is there something in particular that you can point to that says that would explain why Oregon continues to rank in the bottom 10?
Well, there's a couple of things when you look at the history that are I think important to point out is obviously Oregon has not been cutting tax rates as we've seen all across the country. So you fall further behind just by, you know, not cutting taxes. Then you talk about tax increases that have happened over that period of time and adding to the damage, right? And so those are some key top line elements. But you look at things like the property tax burden, which is one that we've talked about a lot, something that we hear almost as the top tier issue from legislators everywhere as they go to the doors and talk to their constituents. But the property tax burden in Oregon was about middle of the pack back in 2008 at number 28. You've fallen all the way down to number 36 now in that key element in terms of property taxes that affects so many people. And, you know, renters forget that property taxes affect them too and get passed along in the form of higher rent. But you also look at everything out of income taxes and property taxes, and of course, Oregon not having a statewide general sales tax anyways. And you look at all the other ways that government collects its revenue through fees and excise taxes and other things like that. And Oregon has fallen from 34th in that category all the way down to 46th since the first edition of Rich States, Poor States. So you can go category by category at richstatespoorstates.org and see for yourselves where Oregon has seen this slippage and been stuck now in that bottom 10 ranking now, as you mentioned, for well over 15 years.
Yeah, it really is disappointing. Maybe we need to change who's in charge here in Oregon. All right, everyone stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan, including something he may not have been aware of when they developed those rankings. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist over at the American Legislative Exchange Council. I highly encourage you to encourage your representatives in government at city, state, and local levels to go ahead and join ALEC. You can do that by going to alec.org, and we'll link that up on ispyradio.com as well. And so, Jonathan, in the time that we have left, we want to zero in on some of these policies that Oregon is doing to continually drift downwards. As I said, our highest rating with you guys was the very first year, and we have progressed downward ever since. You had mentioned a couple of things that are causing that. One of the things that we were talking about during the break was the impact of state employees.
Well, you know, it's a huge one that kind of people don't necessarily think about fully sometimes. But when you look at the size and scope of Oregon government, not the services that it provides, but the bureaucracy that it employs, the number of employees as a percentage of your population used to be among this will surprise a lot of people, Oregon actually was among the most sparsely populated government employees state per population in the first edition of Rich States, Poor States, and you've rapidly hired up a huge government workforce, and now you find yourself middle of the pack in that category. So a huge change in that variable over these 18 years in Rich States, Poor States, you know, and that isn't just current salary costs that are going to be the thing that's concerning, as you and I were talking about. It's the pension liabilities and pension costs for all those employees, the health care that taxpayers are on the hook for, not just in current employees, but retiree health care as well before mm-hmm. they get to Medicare age, let's say. And so these are massive liabilities that are not even in the current budget forecast many times that you see for Oregon or the deficit number that you see reported. These are unfunded liabilities that are out there that are promises made to current employees or retirees that in many cases have not even been funded. And so you think taxes are bad in Oregon. The reality could be much, much worse if the government of Oregon continues to go on this kind of a hiring spree in the years ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like compound interest. You know, the more people you have on the retirement, and the more people that go into government, the worse it's going to end up getting over time there. So
well, I was just going to mention is then you have this kind of silly idea that I see floated in the news every now and then that you have these folks that are in charge of the pension systems in Oregon saying, we don't even need to invest based on financial returns. Yes. We can invest based on ESG and other environmental or social causes. And it's like, you know, it's hard enough to make money in this environment when you're focused on purely making money, let alone when you're focused on other kinds of social or political goals. And so that always strikes me as something that is complete and utter financial decision making when you see those statements from folks in Oregon.
Yeah, it's Well, speaking of nonsensical things, due to its net zero climate change hysteria, Oregon is pushing some expensive regulations and fees to solve imaginary problems that is going to drive up energy costs for businesses and families. And we discovered this a few weeks back, talking to Jen Hammaker of Oregon Natural Resource Industries. And there is an industry insider that had put her onto this. And what's going to happen is right now, we are dealing with a climate protection plan. It's executive order that is being phased in. And we are currently in phase one, which is kind of gradual. You know, it's typically stupid ideas in that it thinks money will solve the imaginary problem of climate change. But in the long term, it's such a horrible plan that actually some Republicans in the legislature were actually looking to replace it with a carbon cap and trade scheme. And their thinking, if you can call it that, is that we should take the slightly less poisonous poison pill. But what it's going to do is that when phase two kicks in after the next election in 2028, the climate change fees for something like natural gas is going to be more expensive than the gas itself. And an industry insider said it's going to triple it. And then on top of that, we also had ODOT, and this was a bill, HB 2025, that was nearly passed. And that would have been the largest tax increase in history in Oregon. It was something like $12 billion just for that. So in your ratings, how would those things have affected Oregon's economic outlook?
Well, I mean, I guess the real question is how much competition do you want to give New York for number 50 in economic outlook rankings, right? Because if adopting those two things together, I think you do put Oregon in contention for being among the very worst of the worst in a perennial basis, right, unless things are changed. And you look at things like electricity rates for commercial and residential, industrial. This is something we look at our ALEC Energy Affordability Index. But it's something as we are very much considering putting in future additions directly of rich states, poor states, because it has that big of an impact on competitiveness for job creators, as well as just sustainability for taxpayers going forward to cover those really big mandates and big government ideas when it comes to electricity markets. You know, the other thing that is really sad about that scenario, Mark, that you mentioned is natural gas is being targeted. You know, natural gas is affordable, reliable, and by almost all objective measures, one of the cleanest ways to actually provide that kind of affordable, reliable energy. Since you have these kind of environmentalist extremists that won't even consider hydro as a clean source of energy, for instance, that don't want to build nuclear. And so what are the other options out there? I mean, it's just unbelievable if people want to have the light switch work when they go on to try to turn that light bulb on. We're going to need to have absolute affordable, reliable energy. And anything that targets natural gas is, I think, an absolute non-starter.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, it's a clean gas. But when it comes to sound environmental policies, unfortunately, the Democrats are the last ones you should be asking for those. Jonathan, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Mark.
I really do hope that this big, beautiful bill represents the start of a tremendous mindset change. But it is also, for certain, starting to disentangle the left from free taxpayer money. One of the areas we didn't get into very much was the defunding of the green movement, and that is now having rollover effects in places like California that are suddenly pulling back on climate change spending because the money just isn't there. Funny how that works. It's not that they believed in science, they believed in the money. And now that there is no money, suddenly their belief system is changing. It's amazing how when you're not paid to believe something, suddenly you just don't believe anymore. But to keep this mindset change going, it's up to us to keep the pressure on. Because as we say every week, the best information is no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.